Hear that? The Queen City's calling you. Charlotte is an oasis of culinary adventure waiting to be explored. As bold flavors excite your taste buds, unexpected menus spark your curiosity, and epic rooftop views ignite your senses. From whitewater rapids to heights that defy the laws of gravity, a new thrill is found around every corner. But no matter where you find yourself in Charlotte, you'll instantly find yourself at home. Plan your trip at charlottesgotalot.com.
Are you a lifelong learner searching for the next career lane? Fix Auto USA is a top collision repair provider that offers opportunities for continuous training and education, with an emphasis on emerging technologies, giving back to the community, and uplifting its team members. Fix Auto USA may be the perfect fit for you. Visit fixautousajobs.com for more. That's fixautousajobs.com.
It's the Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Hey, good morning and welcome to the show. The Back Nine Boys Golf Show is brought to you by Club Car, the leader in sport, utility, and personal vehicles, by RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community, by Bridgestone Golf, get fitted for your Tour B ball today, and by the club at Sea Palms. On the show, we're going to be talking with Drew Braswell with the GSGA. We're going to be talking about the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame, the inductees, the ceremony, the banquet for 2024. We are also going to be talking with John of Golf Data Tech about the trends and the brands in equipment that are being sold, apparel and shoes and gloves. And then we'll end up talking with David Arrington, who is the short game instructor at the Sea Island Golf Performance Center. I learned a lot from the interview, and I hope you will too. But first, let's get to Drew Braswell. Good morning, Bruce, or Drew.
Good morning, Rich. How are you?
Too many names here. Sorry about that.
No worries. It's great.
I don't know where that came from. Out of left field, I'm sure. Well, all right. So, 2024 Georgia Golf Hall of Fame induction ceremony and banquet. Tell us all about that.
Yes, sir. So we've got just a few short weeks left before it's game time. So every year, the Georgia State Golf Association will host the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame, and it is historically held at the Atlanta Athletic Club in Johns Creek. Yeah, in Johns Creek, Georgia. I mean, they are phenomenal. They roll out the red carpet for us every year. It's a great event. It is on March the 23rd. It's a Saturday. It's just a time where we get to honor all of the Golf Hall of Fame members, the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame members, as well as specifically this night is more focused on the four new inductees that we'll have for that specific year. And this year we've got four amazing people that are well worthy of the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame. And just real quickly, I'll run through the names. It's John Gehring. He is a PGA professional. Bob Royak, Cindy Schreier, and the late Carl Seldon, who was also a PGA professional. And I'll just give a quick little bio on each.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, just so you'll know a little bit about these people. So the first one is John Gehring. John was born here in Atlanta. He attended Wake Forest University in North Carolina. Fun fact, he played on the same golf team with Arnold Palmer.
Oh, wow.
And so in 1957, this is after Arnold had graduated already. But back in 1957, he won the ACC championship.
Wow.
So following golf, he enrolled, enlisted in the Army, and then he began his career in golf. He was the head pro at Atlanta Country Club, at Sea Island Golf Club, at Peachtree Golf Club. So a lot of these well-known Atlanta area, or even Sea Island being a little farther outside of Atlanta, just really well-known courses he was the head pro at. I'll tell you, Rich, he is widely regarded as one of the best golf instructors of that time.
No kidding.
And such an amazing instructor that in 1981, he was awarded PGA of America's PGA Golf Professional of the Year.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, what an honor for that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a national honor. And John is one of the most humble guys I've ever met. And even talking to him this morning, he's still trying to figure out how he's worthy of this, how he deserves to be in. And everybody I talk to, and I'm not from Atlanta, so I don't have a lot of the history here. I've been in Atlanta for about 3 years, but everybody I talk to in Atlanta, glowing reviews for John. And so they're all so happy that he's in. Next, Bob Royak. Bob was actually born in New York. He started playing golf when he was really young, and he actually won the New York State Boys Junior Amateur in 1979. And then following that, for college, he moved down to Florida and joined the University of Tampa golf team, was All-American third team in 1983. And then it wasn't until kind of once he was eligible for senior golf, right? So that's when his game kind of just it ramped up. It peaked, if you will. I'm still waiting on my golf game to peak. One day maybe it will, but it hasn't gotten here yet. But his when he was eligible for the senior golf, like that's where it took off. It was he was winning left and right. He's won so many different tournaments. We don't have time for me to list them all. But just a couple of the highlights. He's won multiple Georgia State championships. He's won so many four ball championships. But the highlight of his career, if you ask him, he would say, and in agreement, I would say, is the 2019 U.S. Senior Amateur Champion. And that was held in Raleigh, North Carolina. So nationally, he was the top golfer. And so, which is no surprise if you ask people here in Georgia, his other senior golfers, he's a standout. He really is. And so we get the honor and the opportunity to really honor him and highlight his career and just what he's done for the game of golf here in Georgia. And then our third inductee is Cindy Schreier. Cindy was born in Forest Park, Georgia, just right outside kind of the airport area. She didn't get an early start to golf. She started playing around 15. She took to the game really quickly. She was taught by her dad. And then she used to play a lot with her brother, excuse me. And caught on so quickly. So she started playing at 15 and won the inaugural Georgia Girls Championship shortly thereafter. Following high school, she earned a scholarship to UGA. So she was a dog. And then won the 1984 NCAA Individual Championship and 1986 U.S. Women's Amateur Public Links Championship. And then following college, she joined the LPGA and she played on the tour for 16 years. She won, I'm going to say 20, I think it was 23 top, or she had 23 top 10 finishes and one win. And so just was one of the top women's golfers in her college years. And then following college was just a real standout.
Yeah. And there was a lot of good lady players at that point on the LPGA that are also now in the World Golf Hall of Fame during that time.
That's right. That's right. So she used to play a lot with her brother and I think I'm correct in saying this, but I think she played on the boys golf team in high school, because they didn't have a girls team. But even then, like she was beating a lot of those boys that she was playing with. So golf was just, it was really natural to her. And so our fourth inductee on March 23rd is going to be Carl Seldon, the late Carl Seldon, passed away in July of 2020. But I'm so glad that we get the honor of just remembering him in this way. and honoring his legacy. So Carl was born in Atlanta, another Atlanta guy. He went to Clark College, played golf and basketball in college. Following college, he enrolled in the Army, and he was there for 2 years. And Carl made history by becoming the first African-American to join the PGA in Georgia.
Wow.
So really a trailblazer. Everybody that I talked to in that circle with him, they glow about him. They rave about him. He was the PGA head pro at the City of Atlanta golf courses. And so that was kind of his niche. He loved to teach people, specifically young people. He was such an ambassador for the game of golf. When it came to Atlanta's youth, he saw the need there. He saw how he could be a good example, a good role model for these kids, not only in golf, but in life. And,
yeah.
And I mean, you know, Rich, how golf is more than just a game of golf, right?
It is.
It's a social, social game, but it's also a game where growing up, my dad taught me how to play, but there's so much more to golf than just the game. You know, it's how to be a man of integrity. And so this is what he really wanted to instill in those kids. And again, like I said, he passed away in 2020, but he left such an amazing legacy here in the Atlanta area when it comes to the golf community and just the junior golf in that area. So those are the four that we get to honor on March the 23rd. We'd love to have everybody that can be there attend. It's open to the public. Again, it's at Atlanta Athletic Club. If you want to get tickets, you can go to our website. That's www.gsga.org. That's GSGA for Georgia State Golf Association. We'd love to have anybody that wants to come out.
Well, you know, each one of them has a special gift that they were able to pass along. I mean, teaching adults is great for this game of golf, which really is a game of life. But Carl working with the kids, I mean, that is truly a gift and an act of love just to be able to work with the kids and try and get them into this game that they could play forever.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Kids are hard to reach anyway.
Yeah.
Being a dad, I know how hard it is to get kids to stop and listen. Yeah. But when it's your passion, I mean, that's what you want to do.
Right. So let me ask you this, Drew. How do you get nominated? And can anybody be nominated, or are there certain requirements that have to be as far as the Georgia State Golf Association is concerned?
Yes, sir. So anyone can nominate anybody at any time. We have a nomination form on our website. I will say, don't assume that someone's already been nominated. If you think someone is worthy of the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame, put in a nomination. A lot of times we'll see, you know, we'll hear the comment, "Oh, I thought they were already nominated. Why are they not in?" You know, so. But once the nomination, once we receive that nomination, it stays active for 10 years, and the deadline, each year we have a deadline for submission in order to be considered for that year. And that's July 1st. Once the nominations are received, we have a specific Hall of Fame committee, and we meet a few times each year, and they'll go over every single nomination, read over all the details, all the achievements, and so the committee decides each year who those four are that are going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Huh. And you've got 131 members, and now plus these four new ones, so it'll be 135.
That's right.
It's an honor, obviously, to be nominated, even more so to be voted in to the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame.
That's
what
right.
a great opportunity and a That's great. Right. A great thing to happen. Mm-hmm. Give us
we've
the website
list.
Again.
I was going to say, just real quick, we've got a list of every single Hall of Fame member on our website. So if anybody's interested in seeing who they are, you can easily find that out.
And give us the website again so folks can purchase tickets if they want or just find out more about it.
Yes, sir. It is www.gsga.org. That's GSGA for Georgia State Golf Association.
And Drew, how many people usually show up in attendance? I mean, I'm sure the family and friends and people that may know the four inductees would be there, but how many others show up?
So we typically have anywhere between 300 and 350 people.
Really? Wow.
Every year. Yeah. Okay. It's a big deal. And it's funny, Rich, a lot of times I'll hear after the event, man, and usually from the new inductees, man, I didn't know it was such a big event. I didn't realize it was this well done. And so it's a red carpet kind of night.
Right.
So, and it starts out again with the cocktail hour. It's just a time to hang out. For those of your listeners that are familiar with Athletic Club, they've got what they call the 1898 house. It's in the back. It's on the back side of the clubhouse to where it overlooks the golf course. And so they've got a nice little patio out there, and that's where we have our cocktail hour, our reception. And we have memorabilia tables out there for the inductees to show off kind of some of their stuff, trophies,
wow,
or bags,
yeah,
and clippings, that kind of stuff. And just to kind of hang out and get to know each other. And then following that, we have the members dinner, or the induction dinner, and then the ceremonies begin.
Mm-hmm. How cool is that? I mean, what do you do during the ceremony? We've got about a minute left. What do you do for the ceremony?
Sure. So it's each individual inductee is recognized one at a time. And so once they're introduced, there's a quick little video that our communications team has put together. It's usually 6 or 7 minutes, but just tells the basic why of the inductee and their worthy, achievements in order to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And
then
they give a little speech, and it's just a great night of honoring them and just the game of golf in Georgia.
Yeah, that is really, really cool.
Yeah.
Drew, thank you for being with us. I appreciate you giving us the info on the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame and the ceremony and how they get in and who the four people are. That's just great. So thanks again for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Rich.
Hey, guys. Paul Tesori here, caddy for Tom Kim. Glad to be on the Back Nine Boys podcast. I hope to be on again soon.
And welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. We're on the phone with John Krasmiak of Golf Data Tech. And John, thank you again for being with us.
Well, thanks, Rich. Good to be here.
All right. So let's talk about some of the equipment sales coming off the PGA show. What have you learned as far as your research?
Well, I mean, the good news is 2023, you know, which is seems like ancient history, but is only less than 2 months ago. 2023 was, you know, a pretty good year. We saw club sales kind of peak a little bit and fall slightly, but it was more than made up for by golf ball sales because we had really good weather. Rounds played were up, so we saw a lot of people out playing golf late into the year, and that drove the overall sales of golf balls and gloves, consumables, to higher levels. And so in total, the equipment business was pretty flat, which, you know, in some years you'd go, well, that's not good, is it? And the reality is it is good because we're about 40% higher than we were in 2019, which was the last full year before the pandemic. So that just kind of gives you a relative measure of where we sit. As we go through the first couple months here of 24, January was generally across most of the United States a horrific month weather-wise for golf. It was cold, it was wet in the areas where they typically play, particularly in the Southeast. So that really put a damper on things like consumables. Overall, you know, I think we're in pretty good shape. Rounds played were down 17% for January, but that by itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's just January is a small month. It represents less than 3% of total rounds. And, you know, you never want to start off in the hole, but if you're going to have a bad weather month, January is a good month to have it because you have plenty of time to make it up. And certainly from what we've seen, February for most of the country seems to have been very good.
And that obviously is due to weather. Getting back to equipment, what has been selling the most? Has it been full sets of irons, drivers, hybrids?
Yeah, 23 was pretty much it was a year when irons came back. It was a pretty good year for irons. The driver category was a little soft, a little softer than irons. Part of what, you know, a lot of these things are just cyclical, depending on the perceived technology that some of the big brands may have out there that kind of stimulate demand. Last year was a year when there were a lot of really good iron brands or a lot of good iron models out there that stimulated people to buy versus this year. I think there's a lot of indications that people are probably going to be shifting back into the driver mode. You know, and they typically, it's very rare other than say pandemic years that you'll see both irons and drivers go, you know, off at the same time. Reality is people usually are going to choose one or the other when it comes time to make their purchase. And certainly that with the, you know, the price of a driver today at, anywhere from $600 if it's a standard driver up until, you know, up over $1,000 if you're getting some customized. It's a considered purchase, and people kind of weigh what they're going to buy and make a decision to buy one or the other. It's rare they buy both.
You know, the interesting thing is that if you look at the marketing, and I know you do and I know I do, you know, it seems that, you know, each year the drivers come out, you know, they all say we're up to the max as far as what we can do, and this driver is going to go 15 to 20 yards farther. And if you add it up over the last 3, 4, 5 years, as far as a marketing standpoint, we should be hitting our drivers with no issue, no weight lifting, 330 yards with no problem. But we know that's not the case.
You're not hitting it that far, Rich?
If I hit it twice.
I think the reality is the club manufacturers, as much as the, you know, the powers that be would love to rein them in, they have a lot of ways to improve their products through technology. And they're kind of figuring some of those out. I mean, today you find more focus on the ability to mishit shots. You have high MOI drivers. You have drivers that have more forgiveness built in throughout the face. I mean, there's a lot of ways to make it so that you play better, because let's face it, most of us don't hit it consistently on the, you know, the exact sweet spot. You're kind of missing either to the heel or to the toe or up or down. And if they can make their clubs perform better on those shots, in total, it makes you a better player. It at least makes you hit the ball straighter.
One thing, I look at people's clubs. I look at, you know, what they're buying in drivers and three woods, five woods, hybrids. But it seems like a lot of people are doing a mixture. I mean, they're not doing, you know, full one brand. They may have one brand of the woods and then another brand of irons and even another set of wedges. And yeah, then putters are all over the place, but it just doesn't seem like they're all going to one brand all the time.
Yeah, no, that's very much the case. Every product, we consider each of these as like product subcategories. You know, there are some brands that are particularly perceived as best in drivers. Other brands are best for fairway woods, and people mix those up. It's not like the old days when you bought a, yes. I mean, I can remember my dad having a set in the 60s of McGregor, McGregor irons and McGregor woods and McGregor putter. You know, everything was McGregor.
Right.
Today's golfer, they like to mix it up. They want to find what works best for them in each of the categories. And certainly, you know, even within wedges, there are certain brands that are perceived as being great for, playing from the sand and others that are better for hitting lob shots, you know, so there's a lot of specialization. It's probably no different than if you go to the supermarket and you wanted to get, breadcrumbs. In the old days, you had a choice. You had breadcrumbs or you had breadcrumbs. And that was it. Today, there's, you know, Italian breadcrumbs. There's regular breadcrumbs. There's a million different ones. It's like, there's Japanese panko breadcrumbs. I just want breadcrumbs. You know, I think there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there's definitely a oversaturation, not only in that, but in cars. I mean, in the golf category, as far as brands, I mean, you have the well-known brands, but you have a lot of lesser brands that are really trying to make a mark. Have you seen any uptick in their sales?
Yeah, it is interesting. When I started in golf business back in the 80s, there were brands that were the leading brands that on the club side that might have a 12-14% market share in any of the product categories. Today, the top three brands, top four brands are commanding 75-80% of all market share. So what you're seeing is a consolidation towards the bigger brands. However, in the past 2 to 3 years, as the game has kind of exploded coming out of the initial years of the pandemic, we've seen a lot of new brands come in, and try to carve out little niches. And, every now and then one will, just light it up. Like last year it was Lab Putters. You know, you had Lucas Glover and Adam Scott and a bunch of people all of a sudden were playing the broomstick Lab, and it got attention. So there are little niche players who are making headway, and there's a lot of people trying. From our point of view, we don't have, don't root for any individual brand. We just try to provide the basis to understand the marketplace. But certainly from our business point of view, the more brands doing well, the better we are.
Well, the big brands obviously are going to do well. They may not do as well as they have in the past, but as these lesser brands are coming on the market, they all are not going to be able to stick around if they're all trying to find that 25% of sales. I mean, it just doesn't seem likely.
No, I mean, I think the reality is if you're a new company trying to get going in the golf equipment side, you have to set realistic goals. You know, trying to supplant one of the big brands as number one probably is not realistic. You need to find your way into the top 10 would be the best way to approach it. But it's a very competitive marketplace. The large brands are really careful about turning over every rock they can find to try to find sales opportunities, try to find products, that work for the golfer, make the game a little easier for them. And they're not as oblivious perhaps to opportunity as there was a time back in the 80s and 90s when some of the big brands got a little lazy, weren't pursuing each of these new opportunities, and it kind of let some of the new brands take hold, and that's frankly what happened.
What about apparel sales? Has that gone up or down from last year?
Yeah, apparel sales through the on and the off course channels, which is what we focus on, those have struggled very substantially over the past 2 years. We had, we're still way above where we were in 2019, but the industry has never really recovered from when the pandemic hit, because apparel was a kind of a strange situation, because typically most apparel around the country, at least in the northern markets, which are a large percentage of the markets, they all ship on April 1. That's like a key date when they're going to ship out all their product. The whole world shut down on March 15th, March 19th, something like that. So all the apparel guys were sitting there with warehouse is full of product ready to go, when all of a sudden they couldn't ship them, and all their and the account started canceling orders, and it, as you can imagine, it created a just a bit of a mess in the apparel business. And then they tried to ship them, and they shipped them late, and so everything kind of went out of control, and it hasn't totally come back. It's they had a good year in 22 where they were able to sell a lot, but since then the apparel business has been a little tricky. Some high-end brands are doing exceptionally well. Some of the others are struggling a bit.
Yeah, and golf balls seem to be always doing well, because the fact of the matter is most of the time people play, they lose more balls than they than they figured that they would.
I don't know. That sounds like you're projecting, Rich. the reality is, I mean, golf balls, we're in something of a steady state of decline, at least in unit sales, for about 5 or 6 years before the pandemic hit. Since the pandemic hit, it's been something of a straight up, as long as they've been able to manufacture. If you remember a year and a half, 2 years ago, we had a manufacturing issue that made it very difficult to get balls. So it's a bit of a downturn and a blip. But other than that, it's been pretty much straight up for golf ball sales since, mostly in dollars. Units have gone up slightly, have been going up, but not as fast as dollars, as the average selling prices have gone up, you know. And so those balls you lose cost you a little more than they did before, but that's, you know, that's the way of inflation. That's the way kind of the way it is.
I kind of I see more people looking for their tee that they hit on the drive rather than their golf balls. They give up on their golf balls like that, but they look for their favorite tee.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like wearing the same socks 2 days in a row, Rich. You might have been here, but
how'd you know what I did today? Jeez.
I had a good round yesterday. I think I'll wear those socks again. Doesn't hurt.
Well, I hope you change the other things. John, always a pleasure to talk to you.
All right.
Sorry about your weather being 70 one day and 15 the next, but hey, spring's coming.
It's supposed to be 70 this weekend, Rich, so we're hoping for the best.
All right. You have a great day.
Thanks. Take care.
All right. Thanks, John.
Hi, I'm Jerry Foltz, LIV Golf Analyst, and you're listening to the Back Nine Boys.
And welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. We are with in the office of David Arrington, a short game specialist here at the Sea Island Golf Performance Center. So when we talk about short game and being a specialist,
Yes,
we're talking about chipping, putting, running it up, all those things?
I would say I've been brought here to Sea Island to be more chipping. I'm also a backup to David Angelotti when David's not here or busy. If somebody needs a putting lesson, then I can help with that. But I would class my kind of area being anywhere from anywhere inside 50 yards is what they're kind of wanting me to do here.
Kind of the scoring shots. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people, when they talk about short game, should I flop it? Should I hit it high? Should I hit it low? Should I bump and run? There's really no real answer to that. It kind of depends on the lie.
Correct.
And where the green is and what's in front of it.
Correct. I would always say, you know, look at where the ball is sitting, look at where the ball's going, and then see what's between you and the ball, if you wanted to keep it simple. So
most people don't, though.
No, they don't. I don't know where I got this from, but I stole this little analogy where if you were tossing a ball and you were tossing it to a flag, you probably wouldn't throw it way up in the air and you wouldn't roll it along the ground unless you absolutely had to. Generally, people would always pick a certain kind of flight. Some people pick landing spots, some don't. That's fine. There's no really rhyme or there's no hard and fast rule.
So when people come to you and they want to improve their short game, what do you find as far as the most common mistakes that they're having that they come to you to improve?
Good question. I would say a general observation would be people struggle to control where they land the club and how deep they land the club, which some people misunderstand. You can actually land the club very soon, and it could also be very deep. There's loads of different, you know, you're just basically figuring out what that person struggles with. I would say most of my days are spent figuring out how to move people's landing spots a bit further forward. It's not often I get, so I'm not saying it doesn't happen, it can, but sometimes I find most people either land too early and really struggle to control that bottom of the radius or the arc.
Yeah, and I found that if you're in the sand trap, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but if you're short of the green,
yep,
and you're trying to figure out whether you should run it up or flop it up, whatever, yep, a lot of people, because they don't have confidence in their wedges, mm-hmm, use eights or nines or sevens, yep, to try and run it up, or even worse, they putt it from 20 yards off the green.
Could do, yeah, and I might flip-flop beyond you there, because I would say sometimes some of the best chippers on the planet will putt it if they can. Now, there's always depends what's in front of you, what's your lie like, can you putt it? But if you're just off the green, I would almost favour putting it rather than using your 7-iron. You kind of lose me a little bit when you get to 7s and 8s, because sometimes the ball can come off really hot, and then people struggle to judge the distance. Whereas they've used a putter before. So I would be, well, if that's tried and tested, then let's go that route.
Yeah, I've seen guys, though, from 20 yards, 25 yards off the green putt it because they have no confidence whatsoever in their in their wedges.
Yeah. I had a clinic the other day, and there were, like, it was a ladies' clinic, and I was continuously asked, what clubs do you want me to hit? And I said, I want you to hit the clubs that you're not using. And most of them were the high lofted clubs because they feel like this lack of confidence and they're not sure how the club works. So most of them opted for that low running shot, which is fine. If they're good at it, go for it, use it. But I was asking them, well, what if there's a bit of rough in your way, or what if the green's a bit elevated? And I'm not saying you have to go higher, but it's nice to have that option.
Yeah, and also I've seen folks, and I've had the same issue, where you have a highly lofted club, 60, 58, whatever, and you don't hit it hard enough, mm-hmm, or you de-accelerate coming into the club, and then you why it didn't hit your mark and why you didn't get up closer to the hole.
Yeah, and again, I think for most people, if they start improving the contact, improving the landing spot, then they can start judging their flight easier and how far they're going to hit it. You know, I'll have people say, I'll ask them, what are you doing? Oh, I'm trying to use the bounce. And then I'll ask them, what is bounce? And they'll have no clue. I'm like, well, this is what bounce is. You don't always have to use it. That's a very hot topic nowadays. But once they can put the bat on the ball and get a decent strike, then you can build off that and say, well, it's going to go this far, or I need to go a little shorter, I need to more loft, I need to go a little further. Because that's the easiest way, really, to hit it further is change the club. But when you get to elite players, you know, like touring professionals, they are going to probably use a high lofted wedge for a majority of their shots.
So if you were to recommend three wedges for people that are trying to improve their short game, what would be the lofts of those wedges?
Whew, that's a good question. I would say if we're going to go that route, you would have to know how far they hit the pitching wedge, because now you're into gapping. But I would generally say, general rule of thumb is if you've got a 56-degree wedge, that's probably enough for most people, especially if you're getting scared of the 60. There's no need to be scared of it. It's just you're probably not using it correctly. But I would say if you have 56 and then your next loft is maybe a 50, 51, everybody's different.
Right.
But a good yardstick is see what loft your wedge is and then fill in the gaps from there. when it becomes a bit difficult is when players hit wedges quite a long way, then you've got big gaps to fill. For most amateurs, really, or weekend warriors, 56 degrees is pretty good. If they want to go more, great. Just know that they can, and they just need to know how to use it.
Yeah, I had a guy that I worked with up in North Carolina, and he said more people think they need a 60-degree wedge when they really don't, because that is the most, in his words, the most mishit club in your bag.
Could be, yeah, I would say. But then I would say you're probably mishitting the 56 as well. So, again, it's very case specific. If somebody's got PTSD on a 60-degree wedge, then I'd move them away from it and just see what loft they're comfortable with, and then maybe look to improve the technique or even just the way that their ideas, the concepts on how the wedge moves, works on the ground. And then, like I say, I think 60-degree wedges, some people just don't need them. And I would say, you know, keep away from them.
All right, you talked earlier that bounce is now a pretty big topic. Yeah. And a lot of people who really don't know what bounce is are using the term, you know. And so what is bounce, and why has it become so important, and why is it so varied in the kind of clubs that you have?
Well, people get latched into bounce, and like I say, they don't know what it is. But generally, if you turn the club upside down and you look at the lead and edge, you have the lead and edge, and then you have this high point of the sole. When that high point of the sole gets higher, or if you flip the club upside down, put it on a piece of glass, and you can't get that lead and edge down, that's generally a high bounce wedge. I don't know of anybody that really fits wedges great. I think I've spent a lot of time with Vokey and Titleist, and the way I would fit a wedge for somebody is I would hand them a wedge and not let them know what they're using. So if, for example, I've given players a very low bounce wedge in horrible lies, that if I'd have told them it was a low bounce wedge, they wouldn't have believed it, they wouldn't have thought it would work. Mm. So getting to my little thoughts on this is it's quite important on how the sole of the club shaped, because I have two demo wedges that have the same loft, the same bounce, the same shaft, but the sole's contoured totally differently, and they'll feel totally differently on the ground, even though the bounce is the same. So it's what shape is the sole, where is the relief on the toe or the heel, or is there no relief? Is the sole wide, fat? You know, you can get fat wide soles with low bounces, you can get fat wide soles with high bounces. The top and the tail of it for me is, if you're sending that club downwards into the ground, I don't care how much bounce I give you, it could be catastrophic. Whether you're lowering to the ground or you're not hitting the ground, bounce. I've had players with very low bounces hit excellent shots out of bunkers, grain, rough, tight lies. So you've got to kind of be careful. And a proper wedge fitting is really a good way to start.
So you would recommend, not only from a fitting standpoint, which I know a lot of people are now getting fitted more than they have before, but wedges is probably a very important fit to have.
Yeah, because it's a complex delivery. And I think, like, for example, I could name a player who, a very good player, who was at a facility and a club fitter was there. The player was looking at this wedge and his coach was there also. And the club fitter, who is a very good club fitter, said, oh, don't use that wedge because that's going to be no good for you. Well, then his coach stepped in and said, well, actually, player A delivers the club in such a way that that might actually work. The player tried the wedge, loved it, and took it with him. And that was a touring professional, a major winning tour professional. So I think you have to cast aside this, well, I dig, so I need lots of bounce, or I'm shallow, or I don't dig, I need no bounce. It's like, there's more to it.
One of the issues, I think, with wedges, and I call it trying to be too cute. You're trying to to hit a hard shot and you're trying to hit it softly, but you're trying to get it to the hole.
Yep.
And you end up de-accelerating coming through the club because you're afraid to make a mistake.
Could do. I've seen, I had a lady this morning actually who was actually trying to pause or slow down her change of direction of the club. And I actually encouraged her to go the other way. But by the same token, I had a gentleman, an elder gentleman yesterday who was a lovely little chipper. He could hit that little low running draw chip. And he was what I would call a very short to long. So he was a very accelerated. He would accelerate rapidly through the shot. And that was equally detrimental to his like feel, contact, touch. So you get like opposing, you know, you've got ways to control the distance, strike. Then you can go into like swing length, swing tempos, and everybody's different.
Yeah, it's a wide range of issues, obviously. Yeah. What causes a, let's see, where you're by the green, blading the, and it just goes a lot farther than you wanted it, and it goes over the green. What causes that?
Could be, my first guess would be the club hasn't touched the ground. So you might just have, you might be making a decent motion, but the ball's on the ground at some point. It doesn't do you any harm to touch the ground. Or you could have somebody who lands the club early and the club then is almost taking or going upwards.
Into
the bounce. It could bounce. There could be a plethora of things. It kind of goes back to that low point or that touch point. Where are you landing the club? How deep is it? How are you controlling the arc depth and all that kind of good technical stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I find sometimes when I'm looking up, and again, looking up on a shot is going to affect every aspect of your game, but especially in your short game, if you look up just before you hit the ball, trying to see where it's going to go, you got to keep your head down so you can correct or not.
Ooh, that's a hot topic as well. I just had another lady today. She was trying to keep her head down and keep her head still. And I think it's one of the worst tips in golf.
Hmm.
I think, I'm not saying I want somebody in the backswing looking at where they're going, but if you think of any, if you were tossing a ball or bowling a ball, you would let your head and eyes release with your hand. Because if you're trying to rotate and move forward into your lead foot, keeping your head down and still, your neck doesn't like it, your thorax wants to, your chest wants to open up. And keeping your head looking at the ball can be very detrimental.
All right, so they need to call you, book a lesson, and you'll help them become better.
Of course, yeah, I'd love to. Anybody wants to come out, I love solving people's problems, you know, and everybody's different. And I have a few no-nos that I like to see and like not people to do or have people move in a certain other direction. But most of it is very, very like player dependent.
David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show with Rich Stiles. Go to back9boys.com for all things golf whenever you want it. We'll be back next week with an all new Back Nine Boys at back9boys.com.
Hear that? The Queen City's calling you. Charlotte is an oasis of culinary adventure waiting to be explored. As bold flavors excite your taste buds, unexpected menus spark your curiosity, and epic rooftop views ignite your senses. From whitewater rapids to heights that defy the laws of gravity, a new thrill is found around every corner. But no matter where you find yourself in Charlotte, you'll instantly find yourself at home. Plan your trip at charlottescotalot.com.